You're listening to a podcast hosted by Med Learning Group.
Welcome to the Relief Primary Care Smartcast Microlearning Podcast Series hosted by Med Learning Group. My name is Sylvia Hanna, Medical Director at Med Learning Group, and I will be the host of today's podcast, which is one of six podcasts. In this series, we will be covering the role of GLP-1 receptor agonists in the care of patients with type 2 diabetes. In today's podcast, we will discuss a patient who is newly diagnosed with type 2 diabetes. Joining me today is Dr. Richard Pratley, the Samuel Crockett Chair in Diabetes Research, Medical Director at Advent Health Diabetes Institute, Senior Scientist and Diabetes Program Head at Advent Health Translational Research Institute, and Adjunct Professor at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine in Orlando, Florida. Welcome, Dr. Pratley. It's so good to have you with us today.
Well, thank you, Sylvia. It's a delight to be with you.
Dr. Pratley, to begin, can you provide an overview of GLP-1 receptor agonists?
Sure, I'd be happy to. So the GLP-1 receptor agonists are an important therapy in our armamentarium for the treatment of type 2 diabetes. Now, we've had them for many years, but in recent years, we begin to understand the additional benefits of the GLP-1 receptor agonists. Of course, as diabetes drugs, they reduce hemoglobin A1C, and they're among the most effective drugs that we have. But they also have an associated weight loss and a very low risk of hypoglycemia because of the glucose-dependent mechanism of action of GLP-1. There are also some studies that suggest that certain GLP-1 receptor agonists reduce cardiovascular and potentially renal risk in patients with type 2 diabetes. Among the currently available GLP-1 receptor agonists are liraglutide, semaglutide, dulaglutide, oral semaglutide, and of course, exenatide, which was our first GLP-1 receptor agonist.
Dr. Pratley, patients with type 2 diabetes often have comorbidities. Can you elaborate on the incidence of common comorbidities and how GLP-1 receptor agonists can provide benefit?
Sure. It's surprising how often our patients with type 2 diabetes have either overt or undiagnosed comorbidities. These include things like cardiovascular disease. For example, about 2 out of 3 patients with diabetes will ultimately die of cardiovascular disease. So we understand that there's a large burden of undiagnosed disease in this population. There's also higher risk for heart failure, chronic kidney disease. Now, to put this into perspective, about 40% of patients with type 2 diabetes will develop chronic kidney disease. That doesn't mean they're all going on dialysis, but it's a large enough number that we need to pay attention to the treatment of diabetes and also the cardiovascular risk, because patients with CKD are at higher risk for cardiovascular disease. There's also a 2- to 4-fold increased risk of cardiovascular disease in patients with type 2 diabetes when compared to the general population. And although the trend has been downward for both patients with and without diabetes, we haven't managed to close this gap much. There's also a 2- to 5-fold increased risk for heart failure in patients with diabetes compared to the general population. And this is not just in people who've had an MI and have ischemic heart disease. This is a more general phenomenon, and heart failure is actually one of the most common causes for admission to the hospital among patients with diabetes. Now, our GLP-1 receptor agonists are generally recommended as a second or perhaps third line therapy in patients with diabetes who don't have atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease. And we use them for glycemic control, for weight loss, to minimize the risk of hypoglycemia. However, in patients who have atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease, they're recommended as first-line therapy because of the proven benefits of this class of medications in people who have pre-existing cardiovascular disease.
In 2019, the FDA approved the first oral GLP-1 treatment for type 2 diabetes. How has that impacted patient care? Has this changed treatment guidelines?
So this is really a phenomenal development. Up until that time, all of our GLP-1 receptor agonists were injections. These are peptide molecules, and so they had to be given as a subcutaneous injection. Now, the duration of injection varied from twice a day to as much as once a week. So some of these were pretty easy to take, and needles tend to be small, and some even have an auto-injector where you don't even see the needle. However, the injection barrier is real in many patients and even in some providers. So the advent of an oral GLP-1 receptor agonist, semaglutide, was really paradigm shifting. We can now prescribe a pill which contained the same active molecule as in the injection, and allowed the same benefits, including glucose lowering, weight loss, and we think as well the cardiovascular benefit. What I see is that this has allowed many more people to access the GLP-1 receptor therapy. In primary care, they're easier to prescribe than an injection. There's less education than an injection. And this also overcomes the patient barrier in people who don't want to take injection therapy.
Dr. Pratley, let's discuss a typical patient where GLP-1 receptor agonists could provide benefit.
Okay. I've got a patient from my clinic. He's a gentleman in his fifth decade of life, and he presented to his primary care provider with fatigue and frequent urination. He has a history of hypertension and elevated LDL cholesterol. Both have been pretty well controlled, and he's on antihypertensives and a statin. He was formerly very physically active, but now he tires really quickly, and he's unable to participate in his regular golf games. His A1C on presentation was 8.8%. And a random blood sugar was 240 milligrams per deciliter. His BMI is 34. Blood pressure not too bad, 128 over 78 with a pulse of 82. His current medications included atorvastatin, 80 milligrams, and lisinopril, 40 milligrams a day.
In this setting, what is the management approach?
Well, we have a patient who clearly has diabetes. Both the A1C and the glucose criteria meet that definition of diabetes. His glucose is not well controlled, 8.8%. So he clearly needs pharmacotherapy in addition to our foundational care for education. So it's also important to acknowledge that he has obesity. This is pretty typical in patients who present with new onset diabetes. And we have to consider that that's the underlying cause for his progression to hyperglycemia. Because of his dyslipidemia and hypertension, we can classify him as having metabolic syndrome. And as a consequence, he's at high risk for cardiovascular disease. So according to the ADA guidelines, metformin is an appropriate therapy to start in this gentleman. And he'd probably start on 500 milligrams a daily and then increase to 500 milligrams twice daily for a couple of weeks before going on to a maximal dose of around 1,000 milligrams twice daily. This all depends on how patients tolerate the GI symptoms. Now, some patients are going to have intolerability. That's only about 5% or so if you start low and go slow. If patients do have GI symptoms, you could also consider the use of an extended-release metformin preparation. However, metformin, while good for lowering glucose, is unlikely to get him all the way down to a target A1C. In this patient with new-onset diabetes, there's no reason he shouldn't be well under 7. So we should also think about adding a second agent. And our choices include things like the GLP-1 receptor agonists. The advantage of this class of medications is they have substantial benefits, both on glycemic control. So we very well will get down to goal with a GLP-1 receptor agonist, as well as lose a significant amount of weight. The other benefit that would accrue with a GLP-1 receptor agonist is to decrease his risk for atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease. Now, people who have multiple risk factors, as this gentleman does, are indicated to have a GLP-1 receptor agonist, according to the ADA guidelines. We shouldn't forget the foundational therapy, though. He needs to have diabetes education, and importantly, especially because of his obesity, medical nutritional therapy. Patients can't get by on medications alone. They really need to understand what a healthy diet is, which can vary from person to person, and they also need assistance in getting on that diet. This is one of the most common questions we get from our patients with new onset diabetes.
Are GLP-1 receptor agonists appropriate in patients who continue to have an A1C above target, despite dual or triple therapy with metformin and other anti-diabetic agents?
Yeah, this is a great segment of the population to add on a GLP-1 receptor agonist with. When these medications first came out, we were unsure where to exactly position them, and we didn't have the data about the cardiovascular benefits. So they were often used on top of 2, sometimes 3 oral medications. And in that context, we saw efficacy, both in terms of lowering hemoglobin A1C and in the weight reduction. And it seems like it doesn't matter a whole lot whether or not somebody is on 1 oral medication or 3 oral medications. The GLP-1 receptor agonist effect is pretty similar across the spectrum. So we can think of them as drugs for early diabetes, but we can also think of them as drugs that are appropriate in patients who have later stage diabetes. In fact, the ADA recommends GLP-1 receptor agonist as the first injectable therapy.
How do you implement patient-centered glycemic management for patients with type 2 diabetes?
So that's a great question. I think of myself as the coach. And in my view, the patient is the one who is in the game and playing it on a daily basis. So we need to have a way of working with our patients to get them on board with what we think might be the most effective therapies, but also understand their perspective. This comes with several steps, and this is really nicely summarized in the ADA decision cycle for patient-centered glycemic management. First of all, we need to assess the key patient characteristics. What's their lifestyle? What are their comorbidities and their clinical characteristics? Do they have any special issues such as depression? And are there any other things like the cultural or socioeconomic context that we need to be aware of? We need to consider these factors that can impact on the choice of treatment. So for example, how high is their A1C? What is their weight or their BMI? What are the side effect profiles of the medication? And do they have comorbidities such as atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease that would suggest we need to go down specific pathways? We need to then discuss this with the patient and engage in a shared decision-making exercise with the patient. So what I typically do is walk through some of the risk factors that I see, issues that I think are important, and get the patient feedback on what they would like to accomplish with their treatment. And then we arrive at some targets. So what would you like to do? Well, you know, I'd like to get my A1C under control, and I would love to lose a little bit of weight. Okay, here are the choices that will help you get to goal. Or potentially, I also see that you have cardiovascular disease. This class of medications is very helpful. What do you think about trying something in this class, which also will lower your A1C and body weight? It's that kind of discussion that really is at the core of shared decision-making. Once we agree on the plan, then we have to implement the plan. So this means prescribing the appropriate medications, making sure the patients can access those medications. And finally, as patients get on the plan, we need to monitor and support them. So are they having adverse events? Are they having hypoglycemia, for example? This is not a common complication of GLP-1 receptor agonists, but it certainly does occur in patients who were treated with insulin or sulfonylureas. And we can do something about that by altering medications. We could also assess whether or not patients have adverse events or nausea from the GLP-1 receptor agonists and give them advice on how to mitigate or minimize that side effect. And then always understand that we're trying to see whether or not patients are getting to the chosen target. And if they're not, adjust the management plan. So I like to look upon this as a continuous quality improvement cycle for my patients with diabetes.
And how do you personalize diabetes care specifically?
Well, it comes with assessing these multiple factors. So first of all, what kind of diabetes are we dealing with? Is this a typical type 2 diabetes patient? Are they more insulin resistant? Or do in fact they have more insulin deficiency? It's important to realize that patients who are older can present with autoimmune diabetes, particularly if they're on the leaner side and if their glucose levels are high, you should suspect that. The second is, how far from the hemoglobin A1C target are they? There's some drugs that are great, really well tolerated, but aren't going to get you to goal. So what are the steps that we need to do to get somebody to goal? What are the side effects or potential contraindications of the medications that are available? And we should be aware of things like the need to use metformin in patients who have an EGFR above 30, for example, or to avoid the sulfonylureas in patients who are at particular risk for hypoglycemia. I also talk about the added benefits in addition to glycemic control. Glycemic control is great. This is something we as providers focus a lot on because we know that it's associated with risk for complications. But it's not something people see on a day-to-day basis unless they're checking their blood sugars a lot or maybe are doing continuous glucose monitoring. But things that they do see on a regular basis are things like body weight reductions. How do they feel? And reductions in blood pressure, for example. We also need to talk about the longer-term benefits. These are things that are a little bit intangible to patients when we're talking about risk for cardiovascular and renal disease. But it's often helpful to point out that these drugs have been shown to have a beneficial effect and that we're going to be monitoring risk over time. We talk about the practicalities of treatment. Is it medication in a tablet or is it an injection? How frequent is the injection? Is there any need for blood glucose monitoring or can it be given regardless of what the blood sugars are? So for example, with a GLP-1 receptor agonist, we can use those in patients that have atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease, regardless of what the A1C is, because of their secondary benefits to reduce cardiovascular risk. And finally, we need to be sensitive to price. So we need to be aware of what these medications cost. Some of them are quite expensive. We also need to be aware what kind of insurance coverage patients have. They may have coverage, but they may have a very high copay. If they're on Medicare, they may have problems with the donut. And these are all things that impact on patients' ability to, first of all, access the medication, and second of all, stay on the medication. That's a frank conversation with patients. And in some cases, they make the choice, you know, yes, I'm going to spend the money. This is important. In some cases, they can't make the choice. They don't have the money to spend on the medications. And so we need to think about other strategies to help get them on the right medication, such as patient assistance programs.
Dr. Pratley, we've discussed the advantages of GLP-1 receptor agonists. What are the disadvantages, if any?
Well, we just talked about the cost of some of these medications. And I think that's one of the major barriers to increasing GLP-1 receptor agonist use. In some patients, rarely, we have problems with injection fear. Despite the fact we're an endocrinology clinic and teach patients on injections, I still have patients that are unwilling to try an injection and oftentimes has a historical basis. For example, I'm thinking of a patient who had a mother who had diabetes and required insulin therapy. And not too long after starting insulin therapy, she passed away from her diabetes. And so he's made this association in his mind that injections are associated with bad outcomes and absolutely refuses to consider an injection. Now, in that case, he wasn't controlled on oral medications. And I was at a loss about what to do. And then an oral GLP-1 came along, and then I had an option. So that was a great option, and he's doing well on that. We need to talk about the GI adverse events that are associated with the GLP-1 receptor agonist. This is principally nausea, lack of hunger. In some rare cases, there's vomiting, and there can also be either constipation or diarrhea. So this is an upfront conversation that I have with patients. And I warn them that we're going to start with a low dose of the medication to mitigate some of the risk of nausea. They may still have some symptoms, but try to get through those symptoms. Generally, the symptoms are mild and will go away with continued dosing. They're really related to the peak of the dose with a new prescription. There are some people that don't tolerate the medications, though. Now, one strategy is to lower the dose of the medication because they're still effective at lower doses. And then the other strategy is to change the way people eat. So people who are more accustomed to big, heavy, high-fat meals do better if they eat smaller, more frequent meals with a GLP-1 receptor agonist. In the label, there is a warning about pancreatitis. So I talk to my patients about abdominal pain, risk for pancreatitis. However, the data would suggest from these long-term cardiovascular outcome trials that pancreatitis is not a particular risk among patients treated with a GLP-1 receptor agonist. It certainly does happen in patients with type 2 diabetes. The risk is about twofold higher than the general population, but it's not particularly increased with the GLP-1 receptor agonists. So I think it's still worth discussing with them. And finally, there's a warning about medullary thyroid carcinoma. It's a very rare form of thyroid carcinoma. There are probably around 600 cases per year in the U.S. A lot of them are genetic in origin. The data to date, and there's been extensive studies in these long-term cardiovascular outcome studies, as well as in registries, do not seem to indicate that these drugs cause medullary thyroid carcinoma. But we also shouldn't use them in patients who have a history of medullary thyroid carcinoma, or MEN2, which is the syndrome that's associated with medullary thyroid carcinoma. So it's important to know that ahead of time.
How do you counsel your patients regarding strategies to avoid adverse events related to GLP-1 receptor agonists?
So we discussed some of these adverse events and the things that they could do to reduce risk for nausea. These include titrating the GLP-1 receptor agonist slowly, maybe staying at a lower dose if they have intolerance at a higher dose, stop eating when fullness is sensed, and not overdo the eating. And these things really do make a difference. In terms of the risk for pancreatitis, I warn them about pancreatitis and abdominal pain. And I also mentioned that, you know, as a patient with diabetes, there are increased risk for pancreatitis. But as far as we can tell, this is not increased with the GLP-1 receptor agonists. But this is in the label, and I think it's important to discuss from the get-go. I also talk about what to expect in terms of reductions in hemoglobin A1C and in body weight. So I tell them that, you know, with the medication, as well as with the other things that they need to be doing, such as following a diet, they can expect a certain reduction in hemoglobin A1C and probably some reduction in weight. But I also mentioned that different people have different experiences, which is true and is probably not related to somebody's ability to stay on a diet or their willpower. I think people have different responses to these medications, and we have to accept that there's just variability. I think it's useful to prep patients before that, that they may have a great response, they may not, but they're still likely to have benefit in terms of A1C lowering. So I think those are the main things that we go over in clinic, and it doesn't take long to discuss these with patients, but that education helps keep people on the medications if they do run into adverse events.
And how do you overcome barriers to injection or misconceptions your patients might have?
Well, in our clinic, we have the advantage of having samples, and I typically carry around some examples of some of these injectors, including the small needles. And I have patients actually look at the needles. I have given injections in the clinic with patients, and they see, once they get that first injection, that there really is no pain associated with these injections. These needles are small, they're 32 gauge, and you really don't feel them, particularly with a abdominal injection. I also emphasize that some of these are really simple regimens. If you think about once daily or even once weekly injections that don't have to be timed to medications, that's a great advantage. And then I talk about how these pen devices are really easy to use. You have to dial in a dose, or maybe they come with a single dose and you can just inject directly. But I have having demonstrations in the office is often very helpful. Now, if they need additional help, we can always call on our diabetes educators or even pharmacists in the community to go over the mechanics with the patients. But most patients are able to do this by themselves. And there also is a lot of resources online, both with YouTube videos as well as printed materials that come with medications or that are available online so that people can read and understand at their own pace. We allow patients to self-titrate the medication. So for example, if they are titrating a GLP-1 receptor agonist and they're experiencing some problems, I tell them to stay at that lower dose until they're comfortable, and then they can go up. And that gives them a little bit of control, which I think most patients like. We try to have them have written instructions, and they always have the ability to call back if they have questions. So I think there's lots of things that we can do, but it's really based upon having an honest dialogue with the patients about what their concerns are.
Thank you, Dr. Prattley. That was very informative. We learned a lot today. And thank you to the listeners for joining us. We hope that you will join us for the other podcasts in this series. This podcast was brought to you by MedLearning Group. MedLearning Group is accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education to provide continuing medical education for physicians. This CME activity was planned and produced in accordance with the ACCME Essentials. I would like to give a special thank you to our grant supporter, Novo Nordisk, who provided an unrestricted educational grant for this activity.